From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the 1990s, companies justified giving top executives sky-high pay packages because of skyrocketing profits. Now, profits are down, but CEO pay is still stratospheric. In this hour, the cold, hard truth about executive compensation. First, shaking up the Pentagon's top brass. President Bush has approved changes that will put a reform-minded generation of officers at the helm of the Defense Department. Tom Ricks is military reporter at the Washington Post. I asked him what's behind these changes and what they mean for the American military.
What's behind them is Donald Rumsfeld's determination, I think, to put his mark on the top of the Pentagon. Rumsfeld has recognized, I think probably very correctly, that if you really want to change the U.S. military, you don't change policy, you don't change weaponry, you change personnel. That's what gets people's attention in the military. Personnel means who runs the place and the signals you send about what sort of people you want to see at the top. Remember, the military is like a collection of villages, and he's just elected some new chiefs for certain villages, and each of these chiefs has his own following, whether it's a personal following, whether it's a branch or some part of his service or something. And so we send a series of major signals here about who he wants to see running the military and what sort of people he wants to see them bring along to succeed them over the next 5-10 years.
You describe them as a new generation of relatively nonconformist officers. Give us some examples. What are some of the notable moves?
Well, you're not going to find a lot of hippies at the top of the U.S. military. That's why I said relatively nonconformist. Jack Keane, who's a career light infantry guy who is slated to take over the Army next year, I think we'll take the Army in a somewhat different direction. We'll recognize, for example, that in Afghanistan, it really has been a light infantry fight. That's very different. We haven't seen the light infantry fight really since Vietnam. We have other things, the heavy infantry, which is the mechanized infantry that travels in armored vehicles or armor or artillery. There are no U.S. tanks, to my knowledge, in Afghanistan. Artillery did not play a role in the big battle in Afghanistan last month. Yet, the people who have been running the Army, by and large, come out of armor and artillery communities and come out of Europe. Shinseki, the current chief of the Army, comes out of Europe, as do many of the people around him, the people he's put in top slots. So it's interesting to see that Rumsfeld has put a Marine in charge of the U.S. military in Europe, even though there are very few Marines there, and it's largely been an Army show since World War II when Dwight D. Eisenhower was the commander out there.
What does that signal? Lighter, faster, quicker?
I think for these, yes, absolutely. An expeditionary military is the direction they're pointing it in. Now, the Army's responses were expeditionary. We did Bosnia and Kosovo. We go out to Kosovo and Camp Bondsteel, the U.S. camp there, has cappuccino machines, pizza parlors. It is not expeditionary. It's a semi-permanent base. Mm. Expeditionary is what the U.S. military is doing in Afghanistan. You go out to Bagram, the U.S. base just north of Kabul where I was in March. It really is expeditionary. It felt to me like Mogadishu 92. Conditions are what the military calls austere, which is to say open-ended tents with a cot and MH-47 helicopters landing next to you and blowing large rocks through the tent while you sleep.
And Tom Ricks, you're saying that this new generation of nonconformist officers being promoted or being put up for promotion in the Pentagon means that the entire military will take on more of this expeditionary flavor?
In the military, the old saying is things roll downhill. It is a very much a hierarchy. Yes, by putting a few people on the top, it is kind of a pachinko game in the U.S. military. It will trickle down. The atmospherics, the orientation of these people will trickle down. The people they pick for subordinate positions, the four-star picks, the three-star, the two-star general, and so on. You will see changes, I think, throughout the U.S. military as a result of these selections.
So is this the radical reform that we've been hearing about for several years now? Is this the manifestation of it? Are these the guys who are going to make it happen?
I think it's the fallback position. I think Rumsfeld came in saying, hey, we're going to bring change to the U.S. military, and the top brass looked at him and said, you in what army? And now he said, okay, fine, then I'll change the players. He would have liked to have gotten change a year ago when he came into office. He didn't get it. And so now he's saying, oh, well, I'm going to pick some different people, and I'm going to get changed that way. So while it was not the going-in position, I think it's their compromise. Okay, this is how we might get change.
How radical a shift, then, does this portend for the U.S. military?
It probably won't be really visible to the outside world. Inside the U.S. military, it will be huge. I got a call from a general this morning who said it's the only thing anybody's talking about at the Pentagon today is what these changes mean.
What is the Bush administration's vision, Donald Rumsfeld's vision, at this point of where they'd like the U.S. military to go?
I think you got a pretty good display of it in Afghanistan. They want it to be lighter, more agile, more flexible, able to respond faster, but also able to deal with new, what they call emerging threats, things that really do scare them in the middle of the night. The prospect of a small nation like North Korea, or a relatively small nation like Iraq, having a nuclear weapon or having a chemical or biological weapon. How do you do that? And they're thinking about how do you preempt that so they don't even think about using it. There are new problems out there that they want the military to be able to deal with. The U.S. military used to tell the Clinton administration, we don't do Windows. What they want is a military that says, yeah, we'll do Windows and anything else you throw at us. And you're seeing the U.S. military do that. They're fighting a war right now against the Al-Qaeda network, which is not a state. It's really a state of mind. There is no place you can go and say, we have taken the Al-Qaeda capital. That's a very different mindset for the U.S. military to deal with. I think they're pretty happy with how the U.S. military is dealing with it, but they want to see more thinking in that direction.
And is this new top brass coming in, a group of officers that's going to be comfortable seeing the military in Afghanistan, the Philippines, Yemen, Georgia, maybe Iraq, maybe even between Israel and the West Bank?
I think they'll always be nervous about it, and I think it really won't be over until the next generation of officers comes in. What Rumsfeld and the people around him seem to be thinking about is not just who the top brass are, the four stars at the top of the U.S. military, but also the guys who are about 5 to 10 years younger, maybe late 30s, early 40s, mid-40s, which is to say senior colonels and younger generals, and where those guys are going, what they're thinking. The message they're sending is, we want a different type of guy at the top. We couldn't find that many of them this time out, but down among the colonels and younger generals, there are a lot more, and you'll see real change when we pick up those guys in a couple of years.
The impact 10 years out then, can the U.S. military really undergo a significant change?
Yeah. I think between events and between the type of people they're trying to pick for the top, you could see real changes.
Tom Ricks is military reporter for The Washington Post. When Jacques Nasser was ousted from Ford Motor Company, he went away with $23 million in pay and retirement. Some analysts say that under his watch, Ford went from the strongest of the big three automakers to the weakest. And last year, the company lost $5.5 billion, its worst loss in a decade. American CEOs are paid like no other class of managers in the world, apart from drug barons. Many corporate boards are reluctant to cut back on CEO bonuses, even when company profits are plummeting. And many executives are using privileged information to cash in stock options before their companies stumble or even go under. Now, in the post-90s boom, in the post-Enron era, some companies are reevaluating inflated CEO compensation. Congress is taking a closer look at the abuse of stock options, and shareholders are asking how much is too much when it comes to compensating a top executives. Should company performance, rather than the status quo, dictate how much a CEO is paid? And are American CEOs just paid too much for their companies and their country's own good? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us from Harrison, New York, is David Leonhardt. He reports on economics for the New York Times. For the past 3 years, he's written the paper's special report on executive compensation. Good evening and welcome, David Leonhardt.
Good evening.
It's great to have you.
Good to be on.
And with me in the studio is On Point guest analyst Lewis Gordon, chair of the Africana Studies Department and professor of modern culture and media at Brown University. Good evening and welcome, Lewis Gordon.
Oh, good evening.
David Leonhardt, you have bathed in these numbers for 3 years now. We go down the list that you published last weekend in the New York Times, and it's just mega package after mega package, $50 million, $150 million, $10 million, $120 million. The numbers are incredible, and we know these are men and a very few women, maybe none in the survey of 200 that you got to, that run big companies and that have big responsibilities. And we know that this is a market system that we live in, but this is not the only market system in the world. And American CEO compensation is so much bigger than anybody else's. Why is that?
It's actually a great place to start, this notion of a market system. One of the reasons why American CEOs do make so much more than CEOs in other countries is that this is more of a market economy. Robert Frank, an economist at Cornell University, made a bit of a splash a number of years ago with a book called The Winner Take All Society.
Mm-hmm. We heard a lot about that in the 90s.
Yeah, and that we moved closer toward that. And clearly, the rapid rise in CEO pay is part of that. The idea that we don't have the same government controls on the market system in this country that they do in a lot of other countries. But that's not the only explanation for why pay has gotten so high. And part of the explanation for why CEOs make so much is because it's not that much of a market system.
Explain that for us.
Well, think about baseball for a minute, which has just started.
Okay.
I mean, one of the reasons that Manny Ramirez gets $20 million from the Boston Red Sox is that there are a lot of people who are willing to spend $50 to go to Fenway Park.
Mm-hmm.
The Red Sox, someone in the Red Sox organization decides that it's profitable for them to spend $20 million on Manny Ramirez.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with the CEOs, there isn't that tension. There isn't someone who is trying to get their pay as low as possible. Instead, there's a board of directors that is often subservient to the CEO because the CEO is the chairman as well, or perhaps they're simply out-negotiated by him because he knows much more about the company than they do, or they're executives themselves, and either consciously or unconsciously, that they realize that their own pay is determined by average executive pay.
So if this CEO's pay goes up, theirs is likely to go up as well.
That's right. That's right. And so what ends up happening is that, to a large extent, people are able to set their own pay. And, I mean, I think if you or I got to set our own pay, we might pay ourselves $20 million as well. But there's someone on the other end preventing us from paying.
Or $120. Is there, when you do these surveys, you must talk to people. Is there, I don't know, a sense of shame is the wrong word. There's no reason to be ashamed about compensation. Yet the numbers are so strikingly high. They're so much higher than what ordinary workers make. They're so much higher than what their European or Japanese counterparts make. Is this just the way it is? Or are CEOs looking at each other and poking each other in the ribs and say, hey, ain't this a great racket we've got going here?
Well, that's a great question. I don't know if they're doing that behind closed doors. They may well be. But I think there is a little bit of a sense of shame in that you don't hear these guys defending their pay that loudly. Instead, what you hear them doing, for example, in a year like last year, is they point to the fact that their bonus fell, maybe because their company had a bad year, and they say, this proves that in tough times, my pay takes a hit. And what they leave out is the fact that maybe they got 6 million stock options, up from 4 million the year before.
Which can make it all up in a moment. How about that? In a down economy, which we've been in, I guess the proof would be in the pudding. What have pay packages, compensation packages of CEOs done in a down economy?
They've continued to go up. The truly largest packages have become less common, and so average pay fell. But more significant is median pay, which is the pay of the typical CEO.
Mm-hmm.
And in our survey, median pay increased 7% last year, even though profits at the companies we looked at fell 35%.
And that's about twice the raise that the average American worker received. Lewis Gordon here in the studio. Wow, what astounding numbers we're looking at. You go right down the list that David and others have put together, and the numbers are just off the charts. Is that just America?
No. That's the way it seems. For instance, when we look at cases where there is an executive making 180 times the salary of a worker, that is something just truly extraordinary.
And that is the American ratio.
The American ratio. And in fact, what's funny about it is that we also see this debate going all the way back to the 19th century. There are instances. There's a wonderful essay by a woman by the name of Anna Julia Cooper entitled "What Are We Worth?"
Mm-hmm.
And in that essay, she begins to examine questions of opportunity costs and how investments may go in certain individuals in relation to their output. And she pointed out that there is a degree of health in a society when what is invested into an individual has greater returns. And we're seeing a situation here where this process seems to be skewed. One of the questions that need to be raised is the question of how do we assess health in a context like this, market health, so to speak.
Market health, economic health.
Economic health.
And are companies, shareholders, citizens, I guess, really getting a payback for that enormous investment in a few people?
That's right. And there's also a question of these forms of sociological shifts we're experiencing right now. But I'll come back to that.
We're going to dive into all that this hour. We're talking about executive compensation in America. We pay our CEOs like no other nation on earth. Is there such a thing as too much pay for America's top executives? Have we reached it? Have we passed it? and is a cozy club of corporate directors creating an American Uber class of platinum CEOs. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about executive compensation in America, really about the pay packages, the compensation that America gives its CEOs, chief executive officers. And we're asking, just asking, how much is enough? How much is too much? Does a CEO need, let's say, $147 million a year to be motivated, or maybe $154 million a year to be motivated in a year when their company lost $1 billion, in a year when their company's stock fell 71%? That was Cisco Systems. How much is enough? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our guest tonight is David Leonhardt. He's a reporter with the New York Times. He's written the paper's special report on executive compensation for the past 3 years. And with me in the studio is Lewis Gordon, professor of modern culture and media at Brown University. David Leonhardt, give us a sense, a continuing sense here, I guess, of trends. When did CEO salaries become so large in America? Has it always been thus that these salaries were so outsized compared to the average workers? Or was there a hinge point at which they just took off and the rest of the society lagged behind?
There was a hinge point. It was the early 90s. In the wake of the stock market crash of 1987, and then the recession of 1990-91, and the very slow recovery of the early 90s that still felt like a recession to a lot of people. The cause of it isn't what you might expect. A lot of investors pushed for CEOs' pay to be more connected to their company's performance.
Mm-hmm.
The idea was if the economy's struggling, CEO pay shouldn't continue going up. So what happened was companies ended up paying CEOs much more in stock and specifically in stock options. But they didn't cut the other forms of pay. They left the other forms of pay unchanged, or they increased them at roughly the rate of inflation, and instead they loaded these packages with huge numbers of stock options, the idea being that CEOs would profit when the companies did well. And that's really when pay took off. Then in the last 2 years, the stock market went down, the economy went through a recession, but rather than cutting their pay, in general, pay increased slightly or stayed flat. It is important to note there are some companies that did cut the pay of their CEO.
Tell us about those. What are some examples on that side and on the other side?
Sure. Boeing's a great example on the first side.
Aircraft company, Boeing. Mm-hmm.
Their stock was down 42%. The pay of their chief executive, Phil Condit, fell 78%. Eli Lilly, the drug company that makes Prozac. Costco Wholesale, the big discount retailer. And there's a small bank in Philadelphia, the mutual fund company in Philadelphia, that most people wouldn't have heard of called Lincoln. But their CEO had a really nice description of why he thought it was important for his pay to go down. And he said, you know, we went to our executives and we said to them, look, this isn't your fault. You didn't do anything bad. This was a bad year for the economy. He said, but the people who own our stock don't get to pretend it wasn't a bad year and get to return the stock to the price that it used to be at. So I shouldn't pretend that it wasn't a bad year and keep my pay going up.
Mm-hmm. But in general, pay did not go down even when profits went down.
That's right. Cisco, which you mentioned, is a good example of that. American Express is a good example of that. And what may be the best example is Coke. And Coke set some pretty aggressive goals for its CEO over a five-year period starting in 2001. When it became clear that they weren't going to make those goals, the board just said, oops, and they changed the goals. And they said, you can still get the 1 million shares we were going to give you. You just don't have to do as much now.
And you've made the case that it's not really a market-driven phenomena, that it's a kind of interlocking interests here that keep salaries so high even when profits and share prices fall.
That's right. I mean, I think it's hard to imagine that the chief executive of Coke, who is a lifetime executive of Coke, and who, since he took over, has not overseen a great increase in the stock price or in profits, the opposite, in fact. It's hard to imagine that, you know, if he wasn't given an extra million options, he would quit the company. And it's also hard to imagine, quite frankly, that Ford Motor Company is banging down his door trying to get him to come to their company right now.
Lewis Gordon, let's think about human psychology for a minute. Do you think an executive is really vastly more motivated with $150 million a year than he would be or she would be with $50 million a year?
Actually, that's connected to the point I made about some of the sociological dynamics. There seem to be a form of independent management market emerging, and the independent management market has different criteria of assessment. And right now we're in a world in which one can have performance in terms of, for instance, how the stock goes up. But there's a sense in which there could be a sense of evaluation in terms of how much the individual is worth. Mm-hmm. And if one is dealing with the question of individual worth, that's going to be connected to a quantitative figure on the level of salaries. We have seen this sort of this sociological shift where there's a delimit from performance to the question of a free-floating market assessment in other areas of.
Does that mean a kind of entitlement without performance indicators attached?
And I've seen this work its way through to other levels of management.
Academia, and even?
Academia is a case in point.
Salaries have gone way up in some quarters?
Salaries have gone way up, particularly among management in many quarters, and I've seen it in circumstances where management has. Consistently failed.
So how do we, as a society, begin thinking of certain individuals or positions as exempt from the dynamics that other people face, as just entitled to float up in these rarefied reaches?
That it's very difficult to determine, mainly because we also have a shift in our society around mobility. We have there was a time where it wasn't attractive to be perpetually on the market. But right now, we have found if you're not an academic on the market, or if you're not a CEO that's on the market, then in many ways it's as if you're not working within a rational base.
You're just not a player.
You're not a player.
Let's turn to our phone lines. A lot of people want in on this conversation. Nick is on the line. Welcome, Nick. You're on the air.
Well, thank you. I want to make a very significant connection. Can you hear me, by the way?
Loud and clear, Nick.
Okay. I'd like to make a connection as an attorney, a corporate attorney, in fact, to the excessive compensation as being much more directly connected to the business judgment rule, which is a Delaware concept that says when directors exercise their business judgment, we will give them excessive deference. And what I think is...
What does that mean, that it can't be challenged, Nick?
Yes. It not only means it can't be challenged, I think it's being misapplied in the context of compensation. In most cases, if directors approve an acquisition, a major complex corporate transaction, they exercise their best judgment, and it turns out to be a financial disaster, they've been consistently immunized from suit or financial responsibility or liability. It's come to be the case that when they exercise their business judgment on compensation, it's a free pass. No one ever lately, and they should, and I think it's coming, challenge them as having violated their fiduciary duties because it was excessive, that the process.
So if the board, if the board pays the CEO $100 million, there's really nothing anyone can say about it. There's no room to sue, for example.
There hasn't been in, I'm going to say, a decade or more, a significant challenge to those kinds of compensation decisions, even though people, I think, across the board believe that's the case. And I think the typical scenario that is enormously excessive that you can see is when an executive approves an acquisition or is participating in an acquisition and they get a notorious compensation bonus, even though everyone knows they're leaving the company, and they'll get an award of $50 or $70 or $80 million. That would normally be traditionally called, like an inappropriate corporate waste or...
Nick, you're a corporate attorney. Do you think that compensation has gotten out of line?
I think it has gotten out of line. I think it's the earlier speaker pointed out that not only is it determined by directors in a non-market context, but as I'm trying to point out, there are no legal consequences to the people who make those erroneous judgments.
Got it, Nick. And we thank you for making the point. It's terrific. I want to put it to David Leonhardt. How about it? Do we just have immunized, as Nick, our caller, has it, boards of directors who don't really feel any responsibility or at least any vulnerability, no matter what the size of the compensation?
Yeah, it's a great point. In fact, there have been a number of cases recently in which shareholders have tried to introduce resolutions dealing specifically with executive pay. The company has said this isn't a resolution that we need to consider, and the Securities and Exchange Commission has ruled on the side of the company, using exactly the statute that Nick mentioned and said this is a matter of discretion for the board.
Any notion of that being turned around by the courts?
I think it's more of an SEC decision, and I think it's not entirely clear, but I think that whereas had you asked me that question 6 months ago, I would have said no. In the wake of Enron, I would now say I'm not sure. Harvey Pitt, the chairman of the SEC, gave a pretty feisty speech on Thursday night in which he talked about the perversion of incentives that stock options have.
Mm-hmm.
And so I do think it's possible that we are going to see a little bit of a shift in which it's easier for shareholders to say no to some of these packages. But I'd be pretty surprised if there was any kind of sea change.
Mm. David Leinhardt, stand by. I want to bring into our conversation Kevin Murphy. He's professor of finance and business economics at the University of Southern California. Good evening and welcome, Kevin Murphy.
Good evening.
Hi, thanks for being with us. Kevin Murphy, you know this world so intimately. We've been talking about the enormous altitudes to which executive pay has risen over the last 10 years in the United States, how it's gone way outside ratios that we see in Japan and Europe. What's your assessment? What effect do ever-increasing rates of executive compensation have on the practice of business in the United States, have on the economy in the United States? Any?
That's a great question because, of course, we can describe the escalation in CEO pay in two words, as David already did, stock options.
Mm-hmm.
And in the tremendous escalation in stock options has coincided with also the largest bear market, the bull market we've had in history. And we're still wrestling with the cause and effect. To what extent did the bull market reflect the increased focus on shareholder value that was pushed so dramatically at the end of the 80s and the early 90s? And to what extent has the bull market actually led to these excessive option packages?
So you're saying the positive view would be that the possibility of limitless compensation pushed executives to work wonders with their companies and their share prices?
Not only limitless compensation, but compensation tied directly to the stock price performance of the company.
But that would look at it in a positive light, saying because they could make $150 million, they went the extra 100 miles and created value for everybody.
Yes.
Do you buy that?
I buy that in part, but the flip side of that argument, of course, is that boards of directors and managers see these options as being essentially free to grant,
mm-hmm.
and so they grant too many options to too many people. Here, the abuses are not only at the top executive level, but the abuses of pushing option grants down the ranks to the janitor, to the receptionist, to the truck driver, to individuals who have no direct effect on the company's stock price and have placed very little value on these options. And yet they're extremely costly for shareholders.
Kevin Murphy, David Leinhardt with the New York Times is with us, and he described a kind of cozy club that can emerge in the realm of boards of directors where you have CEOs or one-time CEOs or future CEOs on boards who know that if they push up the compensation of the CEO of this company, they're pushing up the whole playing field that they're on as well. So that there's kind of an internal self-interested club here pushing these things just through the roof.
There's no question that CEOs, like the rest of us, prefer more to less compensation. There's no question that CEOs and other top managers can influence both the level and the structure of their pay in a variety of subtle ways. But on the other hand, this escalation in pay that we've seen over the last 10 years has coincided with a focus on independent outside directors. It's focused on an environment where more and more CEOs are being hired from the outside. What that means is that while I agree that there's not really a well-functioning market for CEOs, it's functioning better now than it did 10 years ago or 20 years ago, and yet pay has gone through the roof. So I think we've got to look for other explanations than just coziness.
We're looking at executive compensation, CEO compensation in America tonight, and asking why doesn't CEO pay go down when company profits fall? And asking, I guess, fundamentally, what do you think when you hear these huge compensation figures? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Steve is on the line. Welcome, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi. I work for a company in the Boston area that stock prices have been floundering for the last couple of years. We have a new CEO who recently made us aware that we all have to make sacrifices. And I hear tonight that he has taken $43 million compensation this year.
That would have to be Gillette if I connect the dots between the numbers in front of me and what you're saying.
Yeah, and just recently they cut our compensation for overtime pay.
How do you feel as an employee of the company? How do you feel about that, Steve?
Well, I just feel kind of absurd that we all have to make sacrifices, and over the whole factory, the amount they'll save by cutting our overtime pay will come to what they paid him in just a bonus last year.
Steve, the line's a little crackly, so I'm going to let you go, but I thank you for bringing us that direct illustration. Kevin Murphy, I just want to put that to you. What about this issue of company morale when employees like Steve are taking cuts, are making sacrifices, and they see the CEO, in this case, getting a $43 million annual compensation?
Well, certainly this affects employee morale, and it's also extremely interesting to note that public outrage over CEO pay doesn't happen just when the CEO gets paid a lot. It tends to happen when the CEO is getting paid a lot and the other workers aren't doing so well.
Uh-huh.
This is why we saw the outrage in the early 1990s. It's why we see the outrage today, and it's why it's been pretty quiet in the late 90s when everybody was, it seemed to be, sharing the wealth.
And David Leonhardt, at this point, do you see a counter trend? Are there pressures mounting to cut back on CEO compensation, or is it just a fact of life?
I think there are some pressures mounting in government, as I mentioned before, and I think there are some pressures mounting among investors. But people will fight pretty hard to protect their salaries,
mm-hmm.
and I think that absent a long bear market, a long period in which stocks don't move, or absent a double-dip recession,
mm-hmm.
I would be surprised if the political pressure, either in Washington or among investors, is enough to turn CEO pay around. I mean, you know, we had a significant correction in the stock market, and we had a recession, albeit a mild one.
And it hasn't done it yet. Lewis Gordon, I want to go to you before the break. What do you think it means for the United States, for American culture? Do these huge numbers keep Americans inspired to go for the gold, or is there a corrosive impact socially from this giant disparity?
Well, there's a clear inconsistency going on when there's a value system that says that one needs economic incentives to perform and then don't put those incentives at the workers in the company. I was really pleased to hear from that other caller a while ago, because it seems pretty clear that some of these packages could be redistributed in terms of an incentive situation among workers as well. There should be something that works uniformly through a company. And right now, the more that there's a severance of the relationship between performance and profit among the management level, the greater the alienation will be.
Mm. Kevin Murphy, I want to thank you so much for joining us this hour.
My pleasure.
Kevin Murphy's professor of finance at University of Southern California. We're talking about executive compensation. Is executive hyperpay good for America's economy, American society? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about CEO compensation in America. Nobody pays their CEOs like America does. The numbers are enormous. We've all seen them. $20 million, $50 million, $90 million, $100 million, $150 million a year. The question is a cozy club of corporate directors creating an American Uber class of platinum CEOs? What's the impact on America economically, socially? Or is this just the market making all of America rich and the top dogs much richer? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. John is on the line. Welcome, John. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I think if you get the right person, it's worth it. And you know, they can make a big difference. If you look at the budgets that these guys are in control of,
mm-hmm.
you know, if you underpay someone and then you don't get the right person, they can blow $100-$300 million with the wrong program. So you need to be very careful. I mean, you should negotiate with them. That's fair, but I wouldn't skimp on it if you can get the right person, because they can make a dramatic impact on your corporation.
And John, when you say it's worth it, is it just a wide open blank to be filled in? Does it matter to you in your mind if it is $50 million or $100 or $150 million a year?
Well, I think the corporation, the director, should negotiate whatever they can do. But, I mean, the important thing is when the person gets in, if they can make the right decisions,
mm-hmm.
make the right restructure,
it can make a huge, huge difference. Yep. John, thanks for your call. David Leonhardt at the New York Times, how about that? Does performance show that getting the right person is worth it, as our caller John says? Does the extra pay, does the record show that it makes the company work better?
It's absolutely true that these are huge organizations, and that if you find someone who can run it much better than it had been running, that they may well be worth $20, $30, $40, $100 million in terms of what they did for the company. The problem is, he mentioned the idea that if you get the wrong guy can blow $100, $200, $300 million. The problem is sometimes we have guys in there who are blowing $100, $200, $300 million, and they're still paying themselves these enormous fees, or more accurately, they're still convincing their board to pay them enormous fees.
Mm-hmm.
So the problem isn't so much we've got these people who are extremely successful and they're receiving huge amounts of money. Is that okay? The problem is that that situation exists alongside a situation in which we have people who are doing a mediocre job of running their companies, or worse, and are still receiving these massive packages.
James is on the line. Welcome, James. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
I'm glad to hear you're talking about things like this, because we also were at my job today, because in Massachusetts there's a $200 million lottery right now, and I couldn't understand that there are people getting that on a yearly basis, but complaining about it seems to be like the mice voting to bell the cat. I don't think you can really do anything about CEO salaries, since they're pretty much in control of the money.
But these aren't gods, James. They're ordinary human beings like you and me.
Yes, they're ordinary human beings like the President of the United States, but you're not going to get paid as much as him either.
Well, so you're saying the salaries, the compensation looks big, but you don't think there's any way to change it?
I don't think that there's ever been a time in this country when the people in control weren't enormously wealthy.
James?
Kind of what you were saying before about
mm-hmm.
the executive privilege thing.
Mm-hmm. James, I want to thank you for your call. And Lewis Gordon, let me put it to you. I mean, America is a country that has lived very comfortably with great disparities in wealth. Mm-hmm. And after centuries of doing that, it is also far and away the richest economy on earth. So it seems to be, in some sense, working. Maybe there's just not a problem here.
Well, I mean, much hinged on several questions. One of them was the term "the right person," and in many ways, there are many issues we're talking about at once here. And one of them, it strikes me, is the question of the old term merit, and merit is connected to performance. In many ways, the question, if we're talking about a basic pragmatic question of whether the accumulative amount of funds are there, whether the economy is producing a lot of money, whether it could be interventions on the level of the state from the level of if we're talking about a Federal Reserve and many ways in which to keep the economy going, there are a multitude of factors involved. But on the basic level, part of the question of job assessment that's being applied here is the question of whether these folks perform. It struck me that you used the term gods. In many ways, we're in a society that, although we may have a public secular position, we do continue to look for gods. And in many ways, the rationalization for these individuals is that to manage companies at this level, this scale, requires having very unique abilities beyond simply a college education or a law degree or an MBA. Within that mix, there are individuals who may have just very, very unique talents, some of which I may not know. Now, in the context of that, we seem to be taking a position with these salaries somehow that these people are corporate geniuses. Now, what we can do is look around us, look at the companies. It's very difficult to explain to a worker who is being laid off or is not really getting a pay increase this year in spite of what he or she contributes to the company, that somehow this genius at the upper level who has, for practical purposes, failed this year, should be rewarded.
And yet, you know, I've known CEOs, and some of them are very good, but I've known plenty who are not and gods.
Right.
I mean, and even if it's genius,
yeah.
Does it take 150 as opposed to 100? Or maybe we shouldn't even care. Maybe this is much ado about nothing. Charles is on the line. Welcome, Charles. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. What made me jump is really the comment earlier on that the janitors and others didn't deserve stock options because they were less important than a CEO.
Yes, I noticed that too, Charles.
Yes, and I could not stop myself from saying, frankly, that what strikes me in this whole conversation is the disparity in scale, the non-linearity of the CEO and higher-up packages contrasted to the lower rankings.
Mm-hmm.
The situation is not to remove the compensation for the lower rankings. On the contrary, to increase that, give you an example, 1,000 shares. Because of that 1,000 shares, part of the company. She went out of her way to find us ways to save money.
Charles, you're breaking up on us, but I think I got the gist of it. This is an administrative assistant with 1,000 shares, probably not much in any kind of executive context, but that was enough to motivate that employee to go above and beyond. David Leonhardt, we heard from Kevin Murphy that there's some thought that the evolutionary step is that lower-ranking employees don't need stock options. Is that where we're headed with stock options?
It depends. First of all, I think that the idea that lower-ranking employees have large numbers of stock options is greatly exaggerated right now. I would be surprised if we moved in that direction, particularly if there's some sort of clamping down on stock options. The first place where they would be clamped down on are the relatively small number that go to lower-level employees.
You're saying if lawmakers move on this, they will put stock options out of reach of lower-ranking employees first?
Well, that's the argument being made by people who oppose some of the efforts to make stock options more difficult to award.
But wouldn't that then just if further grow the differential between ordinary and chief executive officer compensation?
It would. I mean, the important thing to keep in mind is that stock options are not a significant portion of compensation for the average worker, be it a white collar or a blue collar worker. The point that the caller made that I think is interesting, or the point that it reminded me of, is I think Americans are not uncomfortable with people making large sums of money in the way that people in a lot of European countries are. Mm. I think what they're uncomfortable with is the idea that the rules aren't fair. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways that the rules don't seem fair to a lot of people in executive pay is that even on top of the large amounts of money, the benefits are better for executives. I mean, we wrote about an executive who, even after he's retired for 11 years, gets 10 hours a month of being picked up at the airport, or executives who have a higher percentage of their salary as a pension than workers. And I think people aren't so much bothered by the idea that, well, you know, I make X and the CEO makes $200 million or $2 million. I think what they're bothered by is the idea that not only does the CEO make $2 million, but he doesn't even have to pay for all these things that I pay for.
It seems almost like the emergence of a kind of corporate aristocracy divorced from the merit issue.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, that's a big yes. David Leonhardt, I want to thank you so much for being with us this hour. It's been great having you.
It's an interesting discussion. I appreciate being on.
Thanks for joining us. David Leonhardt is a reporter with the New York Times. He writes the paper's special report on executive compensation. Lewis Gordon, this really is one path into the heart of America here when you talk about money and disparity.
Indeed. In fact, when we mentioned earlier about the economy working, the crucial question is working for whom? It's clearly working for this management class, but there are individuals who have fallen to the wayside. There are many, for those individuals, it's not working. And in the long term, we have to find a way to deal with that disparity.
Well, maybe we do, and maybe we don't. We've gone a long time with disparity and the economy's kept on churning, I guess as long as people accept it. It goes on, doesn't it?
Well, in part, there's shifts. There have been not only different administrations, different political parties, but in the end, nothing really lasts forever.
So we may see cycles, even on the platinum compensation. Lewis Gordon, thanks for being with us this hour. You can find out perhaps how much your company's CEO makes by going to our website, log on to onpointradio.org. In a moment, a diary from a high-tech worker trying to look at the outside world from inside an office cubicle. This is On Point. Regina Clark has worked in the fast-paced, high-pressure, high-tech world for years. In this radio diary, she writes about her frustration with her industry's relentless focus on product and profit, and about her longing to engage the changing world outside her office walls.
I've thought a lot about my 18 years in the high-tech corporate world. I think today's corporations are obsolete. They've never understood the price they have paid to gain their power, make their money. They still don't understand the nature of their greed, but neither do we, the ones who work for them. We let it go because it is safe, because the salaries are really good, whether we earn them or not. I thought after September 11th that this would change. I've waited months to see that happen. I used to teach at a university where that horrific, appalling, inconsolable event would certainly have been the principal topic of each day. The working out of the emotions, experiencing the grief, the fear, the loss, the mystery of its happening at all. But at my workplace, part of a well-known high-tech company in Massachusetts, they didn't seem to break a sweat. My manager held a staff meeting on September 12th, and he didn't even mention what had happened the day before in New York City. No one in my division called us together to help us cope with this. We didn't even get an email about it till 4 days later, and never got one from our director. The only notice to all employees was a brief email from a president. No one gathered in halls to discuss it. Even the morning it happened, when we had access to a television in the gym, which was locked 2 hours later, managers openly continued with their scheduled meetings. Nothing stopped. Nothing. It was business as usual. Our CEO never contacted us at all, and after the first week, the only mention to us about anything came from Human Resources, telling us we could see a counselor if we wanted, a week later, in an email. There was never freedom to discuss September 11th in the formal setting of the company. To this day, I find this bizarre and confusing and disturbing. It has never been brought up to a general assembly. There was no community of grieving. In fact, nothing penetrates the self-importance and sense of power in high-tech for those who run it. This won't change until we find another way to access merchandise and services without the price we pay now, at levels most people do not realize unless they are inside, where I have been too long. The Middle East is in a crisis that scares me. I know that the leaders there hate one another enough to sacrifice peace. I see the possibility of it all going out of control, of our attempts to help arriving too late. I can pray this is not so. It is something that is before us directly, vitally, massive in its import, but not once has the subject been mentioned at work. If I bring it up, it's as if I've not spoken, or it seems to melt into the conversation like a shadow thought, until I'm not even sure I've said anything at all. Most of us are good people who are not willing to see or test or think about what would happen if we defied the rules of the company, if we mentioned the outside world. It is a place Alice would find familiar, one we as easily fall into, where nothing matters but getting the product out the door, whether it is finished or not, whether the world is falling apart or not, because getting there first is all that matters. Making a profit is the only measure of one's worth. I can't stay on this job much longer, spending 10 hours a day feeling unconnected to things that matter more than bits and bytes, and to ideas of humanity that are not abstract or hidden or silent, but instead are palpable and in need of my attention.
Regina Clark lives in Carver, Massachusetts. Listeners, we want to hear your story on our program. Diaries like this one start with an email from you. We're looking for essays, emails, or letters of around 750 words in length. Tell us how you're interpreting the changes going on around all of us. How are the conflicts abroad and the concerns at home touching you? Send submissions for future diaries to onpoint@wbur.org. You can listen to other radio diaries at our website. The address is onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded.